Okay, good. Anyway, let's get started. Otherwise, we have schedule issues. So TTC in 3. This is a generic introduction into TTC in 3 and Eclipse Titan, which is hard to do in 30 minutes, but still I'll try my best. Afterwards, we will talk a bit about what we do in Osmocom and what are our test suites and what's the state of those test suites. Why are we doing protocol testing? Well, of course, we're doing this because we want to ensure conformance to some specification. We want to ensure interoperability with other equipment. We want to have test for security-related aspects. We want to test for regressions. And last but not least, also for performance of implementations. And there's no standard methodology, at least not that I'm aware of, or language or approach or tool. You can, of course, if it's a symmetric protocol, you can test the protocol against itself. Like, let's say, with TCP, it's easy to test TCP against itself. Not so much for a lot of the telecom protocols, which are asymmetric. But the problem is, of course, you don't see a lot of the problems because you, you interpret your endian as wrong in your implementation and it still works against your own, but it doesn't work and interoperate with anyone else. Testing against Wireshark is also not a good idea because Wireshark more often than not is buggy, particularly when it comes to the kind of protocols that we deal with. If you think, it's correct because Wireshark decoded it or shows it correctly, always verify that this is actually true. Otherwise, you can spend hours or days in believing that something is correct, but maybe it isn't. Of course, people do custom implementations of test suites and test protocols. Python is a very popular language in that area. Scapy, for example, is a tool that's used quite a bit originally from like security testing, fuzzing kind of background, but you can implement basically any kind of protocol and protocol stack and that. Also, I think Erlang is a nice fit because you have a good binary encoder decoder and a nice syntax how to describe binary protocols in there. Then there are tools like Packetrill. I'm not sure who has heard of Packetrill ever here. Nobody. It's, I think, originally developed by Google, and it's used a lot to test Linux kernel. And it works in a way that you can basically, there's a specific output of TCP dump, so it's very much TCP IP oriented, of course, but there's a specific output format of TCP dump, and basically you can specify scripts of packets in the same syntax. So you can literally copy and paste some parts from a specific Wireshark TCP dump output, and you can then save that in ASCII form, and it will basically regenerate flows based on this description. But it's TCP IP, so not very very much oriented to other protocols like the ones that we are dealing with. So, well, I don't need to tell you about this. I use these lights in other context. I mean, you know that I've been doing telecom-related stuff. TTCN 3, every so often I read about TTCN, not specifically 3, in some specs, I did some research, basically always discovered, well, it's not interesting because there's only proprietary tools and those are not accessible, so it wasn't possible to do anything with it in free software world. The TTCN3 language is a domain-specific programming language, and it was just specifically made or created for doing protocol conformance tests. History goes back to the 80s, so it shares something with GSM there and a lot of the other telecom protocols. TTC in 3, the third incarnation, exists since about 2000. And it's used apparently quite extensively in the classic telecom sector. So it's used in, for example, you can find papers where Nokia publishes how they test their SGSN with it, or you can find other papers from Ericsson, how they test all their core network in elements using TTC in 3 test suites that they have created. So based on conference papers and publications, you can see that this is used extensively, but not in a very public way. ETSI has published a couple of so-called abstract test suites. That's a set of tests. Written in TTC and 3 for a number of protocols, which many people are not aware. There's a quite comprehensive IPv6 test suite, for example, which you can use to test an IPv6 implementation. The same goes for SIP diameter, electronic passports, so the protocols you use with machine-readable travel documents, digital mobile radio, of course, with LE and not EL. So DMR has an abstract test suite published in TTC and 3, also for 6LoWPAN, for example. So there are many, as you can see, in different areas, not just telecom. Electronic passports are clearly not a telecom protocol. But there are also some other specification bodies that have tested, have published test suites. So there's some AUTOSAR stuff, some MOST, this automotive sector, or MQTT and CoAP and so on. Until 2015, though, only proprietary compilers existed, which reflects my previous experience, and it was basically out of reach for us. In 2000 already, Ericsson internally developed a TTC and 3 toolchain, that's compiler and runtime and executor and so on, which they have apparently used quite a bit internally. Of course, not a lot of details are known, but some papers have been published. This used to be commercially available proprietary software. They also licensed this to third parties, so it was an Ericsson product that you could license as an external entity. It's about 300,000 lines of Java and 1.6 million lines of C++, so it's a quite comprehensive product. And in 2015, they released this as open source software under the Eclipse Foundation. Under the umbrella of the Eclipse Foundation doesn't mean that you need to use an Eclipse IDE to develop with it. It's not just the compiler, but this includes lots of documentation and lots of protocol modules, which we'll come to in the OSMOCOM context, as well as so-called test ports. There's also a module for the Eclipse IDE, but I think I used it one day or so, just to use some of the examples they published. There's the log file viewer and filter and analyzer and a parallel test executor, so you can even run distributed tests across many nodes in a network, and the Eclipse test executor will take care of starting all the different processes on the different machines and running them and aggregating the results back and so on and so on. So finally, we can use TTC and 3 in open source software. How does the workflow look like? Well, first we have a human developer that writes some code in TTC and 3 in this programming language, which results in the creation of what they call an ATS, an abstract test suite. The abstract test suite is compiled by the TTC and 3 compiler into C++. So you generate from TTC encode, you generate C++ code. You can then, of course, link in some other C or C++ stuff that you have around. So if you have maybe some existing implementation for implementing a checksum algorithm or something like that, you can just link those functions in and use them. You have the C++ code that you just use normal GCC or G++, and I'm quite sure you could also do LLVM Clang stuff if you wanted to. It's just C++. And then you get a binary executable in the end that you can execute. So this means it's not an interpreted language, it's not a scripted language, it's a strongly typed compiled language, and strongly typed is extremely useful in testing because you don't want a lot of errors only to show up during execution, but you want to make sure even before you compile it or while you compile it that it will work, and it's so very different from a Python experience in that sense. The terms they use is ATS, the abstract test suite, that's the source code, and the ETS, the executable test suite, but well, I mean, acronyms everywhere, but we know that. So what's interesting language features? We have a comprehensive type system. What does that mean? We will look into it. We have parametric templates, because what do you do in protocol testing? You do encoding of messages and decoding of messages and matching received messages against how those messages should look like. So you have some expectation about what you receive and you can match against that. You have an automatic and comprehensive logging framework that will you don't need to explicitly log some stuff. That's very rare, actually. Because at lots of events, the test suite will automatically log everything interesting, so you don't need to do much there. It has a built-in notion of test cases, test suites, of verdicts as a result of tests. And as I said, you have this runtime executor that takes care of starting that. So what kind of types do we have? Of course, the usual suspects, such as integer, float, boolean, with an A, of course. We have then some more interesting types, such as bit strings, octet strings, hex strings, character strings, universal character strings. From those elementary types, we then can build constructed types or structured types, such as a record or a set. A record is like a C struct, basically. A set is any arbitrary order, so you can permutate the order of the elements and they will still be equal. You have a record of, which is an array, and a set of is again the same for the set. The verdict type is quite interesting because it's basically a built-in type that can only get worse and never get better. So you run a test and you say, well, the verdict is pass or fail or error or whatever, and if any part of the code ever set it to fail, even if it didn't terminate the test at that point, any later code that would say, oh, verdict is pass, is just completely ignored because somebody else has already said fail. And each component, and they speak of parallel test components, which you can think of processes or threads, all of these, each component has their own verdict, and all the verdicts get aggregated, and of course the worst verdict wins, so you always get the result of what was the worst basically from those. Structure types, well, it's just like structure types in any other language. You can basically have fields, so you have a record constructed of three fields, integer, here an integer field, and character string, and a boolean field. What's interesting here is that you have an optional notation, so you can say this can be there or cannot be there, and you can even further specify conditions and so on in which this might be needed in encoders and decoders. You have unions, of course, so here we have a union from an integer and a character string, and the nice part compared to C or C-like languages is that you don't have to have an explicit information which of the union members is chosen. So in C you would normally have a union and then a struct encapsulating the union with a field, an enum or an integer that tells you which of the union elements have been chosen. And here in Titan this is built in, so you have a built-in function called isChosen, so you can match on if isChosen union.field1, and then you have some code handling that. So that's built in. Also we have a way to prevent ever using uninitialized fields or uninitialized memory, because all the variables or fields in structure types are always assigned unbound value. It's a magic value called unbound. And if you ever try to send something that has any part of it unbound, so you have a structure or a record and you send it to some remote site, if there's any field that's unbound, then it will crash basically at that point and tell you that you try to send something that is not bound. So you can never use uninitialized variables or structure members. If you want, in these optional cases, if you want to say, well, this element is not to be sent, then you say omit. You basically assign the magic value omit to that variable or to that field, and that will tell the Titan runtime that it's intentional that you do not want to send this particular element or variable. So that's the case. You can subtype, so you can say, well, I have an integer that goes from 1 to 100, and if ever somebody tries to assign a value that's different, it will crash. You can have the same for characters, you can combine lists or ranges with discrete values. So you can say there's an integer that can be 1 to 5 or 7 or 9. You can have length of, so this is basically, you define a record of 0 to 10 numbers of integers, like an array, a variable length array, which can have 0 to 10 elements, and you call this new type regofint. You can basically say, I define a character string that must have a carriage return line feed at the end, and things like that, which is very useful, again, because any violation of these type definitions would basically create failures either at compile time if it's already known, or then at runtime when you go to that come to that point. In templates, that's basically the one really strong concept of the language. And templates allow you to, in both ways, to either send the so-called send templates and receive templates. The receive templates are, I think, the more obvious of the two. So sending a message, typically it's quite easy. You know all the field values that you put in, but when you receive messages, then it's, you know, sometimes some fields are wildcarded because the remote end that sends you the packet is choosing some transaction identifier or some other value that you don't, as the test case, you don't know which exact value will be chosen, but some other fields you know. So let's say in TCP or whatever, yeah, you know what kind of TCP flags you expect from a packet, but you don't know what's the timestamp of the packet. Maybe for the timestamp you only know a range, or you have a wildcard or something. And using those templates, you can basically define such rules on what exactly how a packet should look like, and then you have a match operation, and you say if this packet matches the template, then do that or whatever. You can furthermore extend the templates by arguments, so-called parametric templates. So we can say here, for example, we have a TR is just a convention for a receive template. So template receive, that's a complete convention only. So we can say, well, it has to be A, B, or C, and then you can match any character string against that, and it will only match in that case. You can have something like, oh, a value that's near pi, but not exactly, something that would fit in 1 byte because it's 0 to 255 as an integer, or you can have like positive integers, negative integers, with or without zero, or whatever you may want. And here again, you have something like, you say, 0 to 127 or 200 or 255. And you can do that, of course, also with much more complex types. For binary matching or for bit matching, we have the bit string. Bit strings can have any arbitrary number of bits. So you can have a 3-bit long bit string or something like that. Doesn't have to be octet aligned. And you can say, well, I want to match on something that starts with a known pattern, but the last 2 bits are, we don't care. And you can express this like that. Or you can say with character strings, you can use some matching, even regular expressions at that point. So and then you have some more interesting capabilities where you can match on permutations of something, or a subset or a superset of things, or you can have conditions in there and so on, which I'm not covering here in this simple example. So how does a parametric template look like? Let's assume we have this record again. We had this before on a slide. We have 3 fields, integer, character string, and boolean in a record. And now we define a template. We say the template relates to the my message type, which we have defined up here. And we call it trmütimplte. And we have a boolean parameter that we put in here. This is the parametric part of the template. And we say field one, it must be present, but can have any value. That's question marks, a bit like DOS. No, DOS was single character. Anyway, but that's question mark. And asterisk would be, can it be not present or present and have any value. And field two can be B, O, or Q. And field three must be the parameter that I pass here into the parametric template. So, and you can, of course, from that simple example, you can create quite complex constructs. And you use this either by explicitly calling the match function that I expressed, but also we will see soon there's a concept of so-called test ports, and you can send and receive on such test ports. And a receive statement, you can directly give a template. So the receive statement would ever only return if what it has received matches the template that you have provided. So the explicit call to the match function you almost never need. I think 95 to 99% of the cases you don't need it. So yeah, you can have hierarchical templates. So you can say, well, I have a template that matches any message type here. And then I can say, well, I have a template for message type 23 that modifies the other template, and it inherits all the fields that you have specified here, but you can override some fields in your specific template. So you can start from a very generic one, and you can create more specific and more specific templates that you can then use in matching. Now, the next part is, of course, how do we encode and decode data, because all the protocols have whatever kind of encoding, decoding. Some of them are in ASN1, some of them are just human-readable specified, maybe they're ASCII-based, they're text-based, or they're binary protocols. But TTCN3 specifies how you can import some formal schema definitions. So if you have an ASN1 protocol, it's very easy. You can just, the TTCN3 compiler can just compile the ASN1 files, and we generate C++ for that. So you don't even need to do anything. It's just you have your TTCN3 files and your ASN files, and you throw them at the compiler, and it will generate code for it. Nothing to worry about. For other formats, such or like formal descriptions, such as XML schema definition or JSON schema definitions, also it's the same. You can import it rather easily. But for all the other protocols, like the legacy GSM stuff that we deal with, which are all not specified in a formal syntax, there is the raw codec that you can use for binary protocols and the text codec that's for text-based protocols. Those two are Titan-specific extensions of TTCN3. You will not be able to use them with other tools, but since there are no other open source tools, we are not really worried about that. And the codecs now express how do you get from a concrete binary or on-the-wire encoding to an abstract representation of this that Titan can deal with, and vice versa. And the nice part about this is that you do this declaratively. So you never, like in C or in other languages, you would normally write, okay, if the first byte is that or that, then do whatever, blah, blah, blah. So you have an imperative description of how the parser encoder works, but with Titan, it's a declarative description. So what does that mean? Well, if you look at the UDP header definition, this may look a bit weird if you think, okay, well, in C, I just have one struct that has a couple of unsigned integers. So this is a bit more complex. But, of course, this works for even the most complex protocols and not just for something that maps very nicely to a C struct. So we first define an integer that is basically 0 to 64k. And we define it has a 16-bit field length, it has no sign bit, and it has a last a byte first field order, a byte order in there. You can also specify a bit order and all kinds of things. So we first define us basically what's a U in 16T in network byte order. And then we say, well, the UDP header has a source destination port, a length, and a checksum. And we define the field order is MSB, which basically means it starts with this field in the struct. Not from the bottom up. And then we define a UDP packet, which has a UDP header in front and an octet string as payload. And then we say, in the header, we have the length of header and payload together. We store in the len field that's a member of the UDP header. So basically, you can declaratively express that there is a length field, and it covers this part of the packet. And both the encoder and decoder will use this. So if you ever send a packet, you never have to specify the length. The encoder will do it. And if you receive a packet, the decoder will use the length value from there, and it will truncate. So if, let's say, the packet is longer than the length value, it will truncate and will give you a warning that there's data remaining while you're decoding the binary data. If you look at a GTP header, that's now more a telecom example. You can say, well, okay, we have so this bit 1 and oct 2 and so on, all these types you first have to define, but there's some normal header files that you just include. So you have, let's say, a checksum present bit, a RT present, I don't remember what this is, or a key present bit. These are basically bits that indicate the presence of other optional fields here. And then you basically say, well, the checksum field, which is defined here, has a presence condition of either CSUM present is 1 or RT present is 1, and something like that. So again, you describe and you declare how your message is formatted, and then it will basically create the code for parsing and encoding the data according to the description. I think this is extremely nice. I'm surprised that we don't have such features in other languages or tools. At least I've never seen anything like that. And it's extremely comprehensive because you can even express something like pointers. If anyone has ever looked at how SCCP is implemented, you actually have relative byte offset pointers to other optional fields in the message. You can express that in there, and all kinds of other craziness that you can do. The same exists for text-based protocols. So this is MGCP, which of course we have in Osmocom, as we heard yesterday. And I can define the different parts of the protocol here this way. So I say, well, a transaction ID is a number with decimal digits with length of 1 to 9 bytes. And I say an MGCP endpoint is something that has to have an add character somewhere. The version number has 2 decimals interspersed with a dot in the middle. And it has to begin with MGCP at the string. So and then I use these elements and I compose basically the MGCP command line from that. As I say, well, the field separator between the individual fields can be a space or it can be a tab, multiple tabs or multiple spaces or a combination of multiple tabs and spaces. And the entire MGCP command line must end with a CRLF or, an inverted CRLF with in opposite order and so on. So you express all these things. And then you can just throw an MGCP message at it and we'll completely decode it in abstract representation. Program control statements are just like any other language. So if you're coming from C or C++ or Java or Python, it's not really going to be a surprise. You have just the switch statement becomes select for whatever reason. But otherwise, you have if, else, for, while, do while, go to, labels, even go to, break, and continue. Now we have these abstract communication operations, which mean, well, we need to exchange data somehow with our implementation under test. And TTCN3 introduces a concept of test ports. This is not a TCP port or a UDP port or a socket or something. It can map to one, but it's a much more abstract concept. You can think of it like pipes or some method by which one part of a system can exchange data with another. You have a send and receive operation. The send operation is always non-blocking, so there are queues inside that will basically enqueue the message. And you can send any literal value, constant, any variable, any specific value template, and so on. The receive operation is normally a blocking receive operation. So it will block until it has received something that matches the template that you have specified. And again, you can specify, of course, literal values. That's not so, but the template is the really nice part that you can do. But the problem now is, of course, well, if the receive blocks, how can we wait for any n of different events? Excuse me. And that's where some interesting program control statements and behavioral, they call it behavioral statements, come in, which can do all kinds of interesting things. And look at an example here. Well, you say basically, if you have a code like this, p.receive x and p.receive y, these are sequential and blocking statements. So basically, the first statement waits until the whatever matches x appears on the top of the queue of p, and then you do receive y. But what if the two receive in opposite order? Then you block indefinitely. So that's not very useful. So that's why the alt statement is introduced. So you can basically say, this is an example, well, I'm sending some request to some implementation, I'm starting a timer, and then I have this alt statement, which means, well, either we receive something that matches our response template, or we receive anything else, or the timeout happens, and then I have clauses that specify what happens in these respective cases. And this square brackets at the beginning is a guard condition. People coming from Erlang will know what that is. Basically, it enables or disables this particular alternative based on some value, which is really nice for state machines. So you can say, well, this line only applies if the state is such and such in your state machine, and so on. Now, that's nice, but still it's rather explicit, so you have to write a lot, and you always have to start a timer and handle the timeout and so on. So that's okay, first, before we go there, sorry, is one more slide about the repeat statement. So basically, in the normal else statement, we will execute that section and then continue at the bottom. So basically the first alternative that has arrived will be executed, and then the program flow continues after the entire alt block. The repeat statement is basically something to prevent that. So let's say you have a protocol where you have some requests and responses, and at random intervals, the other side also sends you a keep alive request, and you need to respond to that. So we send a request, we start the timer, we want to receive a certain response. But if we receive a keep alive, then we send some response or whatever, and we repeat, which means we start again at the alt statement. So that happens in between, but it doesn't affect our actual test logic that is being performed. So you can use repeat for that. Interleave is now an alternative to, or is a different behavioral statement, which basically means I have these three events that all should happen, but I don't care about what the order is. So each of those must happen exactly once, but they can happen in any order. We don't care. And that's what you can express here. And then in asynchronous telecom stuff, that's actually fairly common behavior, because you know some things need to happen. Let's say authentication must happen at some point, but the spec doesn't say when exactly the authentication has to happen. But somewhere in the overall transaction, authentication at some point must happen. And then you can use the interleave statement for such situations, which will guarantee that each of the events has happened once, but all of them have happened. Now, as I said, it's a bit verbose, because if in every small part of the code you have to start a timer and explicitly handle the timer, it takes quite a lot of lines of code. This is where alt steps come in. So an alt step is a sort of part of an alt statement that you can abstract out and share and reuse. So we define here an alt step, like a function definition, but it's not a function, it's an alt step, which says, well, if we receive a ping from the other side, we send a pong. Or if the guard timer times out, then we set the verdict of the test case to fail with this description. So the test fails if the timeout is happening. So we define this my alt step. And then my alt step can be used in any other alt statement. So we say, well, we send something, and if we receive, whatever, we do whatever handling, but we can also execute the my alt step. And then we don't need to repeat all the lines that we have in this alt step in every of our alt statements in the code. So we can abstract that away, and it even goes further. We have so-called default alt step activation, which means we can basically say, at some point in our code, we can say, well, activate this alt step ping pong. And then this will basically become a background action that will happen all the times in any receive statement or any other alt statement. So if I do something like this, then whenever my code at any point receives something that matches TR ping, we will send a TR pong in response. But we don't have to handle this in all of our code anymore. We can focus on the actual logic of the test, and all the default stuff is a default activation. Code in TTC and 3 is written in so-called modules, a bit like Python modules. They also have import statements. The syntax is slightly different. And a module consists of definitions that contain a so-called control part or other elements. Such as module parameters. And whenever you declare something not as a normal variable, but as a module parameter, then it automatically sort of appears in your config file for the test suite. So if you want to have a certain value configurable, let's say an IP address of your device that you want to test, you don't have to manually somehow make that configurable, but you just move your variable that holds the IP address in this special module parameter section. And then if you execute that, if you run the module, you can specify a config file. In the config file, you can override all the variables that have in this module parameter part. You define your data types, your constants, your templates. You define your communication ports and your actual test components, your functions, your alt steps, your test cases. And all of that together then builds modules. And you can import definitions from other modules. You can also have private alt steps or private functions that cannot be imported into other modules. And you have something that's a little bit like inheritance, but it's not. So it's not an object-oriented language, but you have something that's a little bit like inheritance. So you can basically say some component extends another component, and it will basically inherit all, well, inherit all the fields and definitions and so on of another module, but you can extend them. So it's a bit like poor man's inheritance. Okay, real world examples. Let's quickly look at that. I think we are running out of time by far. So let's quickly try to look at some code. And we look at, talk about the Osmocom side anyway in a short time. So let's look at, I don't know, the BTS test suite, for example. So if we look at the BTS test suite, we will, well, this color is not matching well with the daylight here. So I'm switching off syntax highlighting. So yeah, you see lots of import statements, all the different things we import, and so on and so on. We see this module parameter section. That's what, oh, set no spell. That's what I describe. So basically, we define, we have a character string module parameter RSL IP, and the default value is this. But you can basically just in the config file specify that, and it will override the compiled in default. So this is how you make parts configurable, and so on and so on. But let's look at an explicit test case. So here we have a function that tests unit data indication. We basically have some helper functions that detune the layer one control. In this case, we clear the RSL receive queue, we transmit some labdm frame, and then we have an alt statement which says, well, if we receive on the RSL side something that matches the RSL receive unit data indication template with those specific parameters such as channel number, link identifier, and layer three message, then we set the verdict to pass, because that's actually what we were testing for. So this test is basically, we have Osmo BTS in the middle, and we attach to the RSL side of Osmo BTS, and we attach to the layer one side of Osmo BTS by means of using TRXCon fake TRX on the other side. So we basically can behave like a phone towards the BTS, and we can behave like a BSC towards the BTS. And we send something on the UM side, and we expect this to be translated to an ABIS RSL message on the ABIS side. That's what we do. If we receive anything else, we repeat. So basically, we ignore any crap that the BTS is sending us, but we make sure that we receive that one particular message, that we send a message here, and we expect to receive it on the other side of the BTS. And then we call some helper functions to deactivate at the end, and that's it. So that's sort of how test cases look like. I don't want to spend more time here right now because we have schedule. Yeah. That's, I have implemented timeouts, yes, on a global level. So if we have, I have a timer here, a guard timer, the GT guard, as a G is the convention again that I use for global variables. And if we look at the GT guard, there's an alt step for the T guard timer. That's one of these, well, whenever this happens in the background, and we activate that in the initialization code somewhere. Yeah, there's here the handler initialization function that says, well, start the T guard timer and activate that default alt step. So basically, whenever this guard timer in the background will expire, it will call that alt step. I mean, that alt step, if we go back to that, it will set the verdict fail, and it will say self stop to terminate the component, basically. So that's what I'm saying. I mean, you don't need to rewrite that all the time, but you just do that once, and it will run in the background, and you will fail when it fails. Okay, now, logging. As I said, lots of things get automatically logged. You don't need to write that yourself. So for example, any encode and decode operation can log the let's say you're decoding some binary stuff, it will log your hex dump of the binary and will log you the abstract decoded value that after the decoding. So you can really trace the code. And any component sending or receiving something, that will be logged automatically. You even have a log format tool for formatting the data nicely. We will look at that in the next example. So this is an example log output, which is very hard to read. But you can see basically here it says sent on GTPC. to system blah 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 and GTP one control unit data. So this is from a GTSN test or something like that. It basically says we have sent this abstract message, and then it will actually say this message was mapped to blah blah blah, and this is the binary encoded part of the message that it has generated. But this is not nice to read, so that's why there is TTCN3 log format, which will log it to you like this, which is really nice. So you get a JSON-like, JSON-similar syntax of the message. So it's exactly the same log files, just post-processing that will show you the message like this, and it's much more readable. And this is the binary outgoing message that it was mapped to. So that's what the log formatter is doing to make it more human readable. Now, and then the next interesting thing is that we have all the existing protocol encoders. So this is a list of, I'm not sure if it's complete, but it's what I could find, all the protocol encoding and decoding. And you see lots of telecom-related stuff here. So BSSAP Plus is actually the GS interface. BSSGP is NS interface. This is A interface. We have GTP is used in SGSN, GTSN. We have ISUP for call control. We have LLC, that's GPRS LLC. We have all the SIGTRANS stuff, M2PA, M2UA, and so on and so on. M3UA, of course. We even have stuff like SMTP, MIME, Google Protocol Buffers, Frame Relay, RTP, SRTP, IPsec, whatever you think of. Even SMPP is there. So these are just the encoders and decoders that will basically translate the binary to the abstract encoding and decoding. Then we also have protocol emulation modules, many more, but those three are particularly used in the Osmocom context. So M3UA, SCCP, and SUA. And then we have test ports, which you can use, for example, a telnet test port that I always use for VTY. So all of our test cases, they connect to the VTY interface of the program that we run. And then I have some helper functions to basically say, well, go to the configure node and change the time slot configuration or something like that. So from my test case, yeah. Yes and no. No. So it only, so S1AP is defined in ASN1. So it can compile that, yes, but it only supports basic encoding rule. Yes, yes. Yes, it's possible, but just for the S1AP. S1AP, I think, is a packed encoding rule, but Titan only supports BER, basic encoding rules. But what you do is basically you use Titan to generate the BER, and then you use some like ASN1C code to decode BER and re-encode as PER. But that's, it's not, it's ugly, but it's very simple to do because you don't need to write the code for that. Right? You have one function call for decode the BER, another function call to encode the PER. I mean, and for most test cases, you're not so worried about the performance loss at that point. So it can be done. They have what they call mobile layer 3, is what Ericsson calls it, and mobile layer 3 includes GSM, UMTS, and LTE layer 3 messages, encoding and decoding. Yeah, okay, further reading, so if you want to read some more stuff, I really recommend this tutorial. It has only how many slides? So it's only 250 slides, but it's an excellent tutorial. I can strongly recommend it. And it's even, I asked, and they have now released it under a, I think even under Eclipse public license. I think it's the first presentation slideshow that I see under this license. But anyway, it's under a license now that we can reuse it. So the next tutorial or whatever I give, I can reuse all the diagrams that they have in there. Okay, good.